yourself, little man. Don't let them tell you that they have the plan, 'cause everyone's lost chin deep in the sand. And what they're trying to sell to you, you shouldn't be buying. Think for yourself, little girl. Don't let them tell you how to run your world, 'cause everyone's the same, choking back that nervous hurl. And if they tell you they ain't, well, they're just lying. Yeah, they're just lying.
This is Bob Brelick. You didn't even look at me funny when I said Tuesday, did you? This is Thinking Clearly, and it's a show about critical thinking, not necessarily articulate speaking, but Thinking Clearly is a show about critical thinking, and that's what we're going to be doing tonight. And with me in the studio is co-host.
I'm Julia Minton.
Trying to encourage you to become critical thinkers and join this critical thinking community and become information activists and vet your information. And we've been talking a lot about those kinds of issues, and we'll continue talking about those issues.
And just try and shut us up.
Yeah, just try. And why don't you, we want to be as interactive and keep in touch with our listeners as we can. So why don't you tell them how to get a hold of us, Julia?
Yeah, you can find us. We're real people. We are on Facebook, Thinking Clearly Radio Show, where we will keep you apprised of our upcoming shows and also show notes. And you can communicate with us. We're real people. We're here for you. And lastly, we're very excited. We have our show. You can go to thinkingclearly.libsyn.com.
Yeah, and that's Libsyn, libsyn.com. And I think this is like our 18th show, something like that. And so you can get all those past shows. We'll sometimes refer to those past shows. I'm going to refer to last month's show. And so if you didn't hear that, you can go to the podcast version. We're also on iTunes, and we like to hear from you.
Yeah, your podcast app, you just open it up, you hit add feed, you search for Thinking Clearly, and pop, there we are, no matter what kind of podcast app you use. So if you enjoy this show, you feel free to subscribe and listen to future shows or pass it on to your friends.
And we have developed a pretty long description of critical thinking, what that is, and it's got several parts to it, but I'm not going to read the whole thing. Let's just bat it back and forth. What's critical thinking to you, Julia?
Putting your brain to work in the best way possible. Is that part of our definition?
No, but that's certainly right in there with critical thinking.
Well, that's what you get for asking me questions on a whim.
All right. And the first part, really, and I think the bulk of the definition or description of critical thinking is to come to your conclusions, your beliefs, those claims that you make based on evidence. And the evidence should logically hook between the premises, the evidence that you're providing, and the conclusions or claims that you're making. So rather than use our kind of intuitive, fast thinking and say, right off the bat, this is what it is, this is my belief on that, we actually investigate things that are more complex. You know, a lot of the stuff that we really need to deal with in the political realm and that kind of thing, it's not just a simple, fast kind of decision belief. There's a lot of implications and information that needs to go into that to actually weed out the alternative facts from the facts.
So there's a thoroughness to it.
There's a thoroughness, and it takes more energy and effort, but what we're trying to advocate for here is that it's worth learning as a skill, employing as a skill when it's appropriate and important for you to do that, and that it takes some practice doing it. We have to break some bad habits of just going along with the popular view or accepting something just because somebody votes for the same candidate that we do, therefore we believe everything they say. It takes some extra energy and effort to do it, but believe me, in this day and age of fake news, alternative facts, in this day and age of having a president who apparently has the tactic that it doesn't matter whether what I say is true or not, It's my opinion about it that really matters.
It worked for me when I was 6 years old.
Exactly. So don't worry about the facts too much. Just listen to what I have to tell you and suggest to you.
Well, and I can say, too, critical thinking in my own life has, I've throughout my life reconsidered some of my existing beliefs or have been presented with new information, which has made me go back and reconsider some things that I thought were true or were my disposition and how I see the world. And critical thinking brings tools to the toolbox for reconsidering those things, which can either solidify some thoughts you have or make you maybe have new ideas. And frankly, changing my mind is one of something that really excites me. I try not to do it too often, but
it can be exciting. It actually can be a pleasurable situation. We get these neurochemical drips in our head that are part of our reward system, and
my friend dopamine,
dopamine and serotonin too. There are these pathways in our brain that give us a reward for something, and oftentimes we get a reward for things that when we hear something that we agree with, and we go right on.
Yeah, you tell them, Bob.
You tell them, and we get that reward circuit going. But actually, I've experienced this. I don't know the neurochemistry, whether they've investigated this or not. But when I do change my mind or I reevaluate my position, I get a little bit of that reward from it. Mm. It's kind of like a letting go of something. It's kind of a newness. There's a little sense of awe that, maybe I was wrong with that. And that's, I think that's something that we need to encourage, and we need to encourage dialogues.
Well, wouldn't you say that it's part of, because I know you have a background in psychology.
Mm-hmm.
I myself have always had this impression that part of being a healthy person is to be dynamic, that throughout your life you continue to evolve and you continue to, that you're not a static person. We're not just the one person we're born as. So to me, it seems like part of a healthy whole human being is being open to new experiences, being open to reexamining our ideas, being open to new information, and to continue to evolve.
Sure. It's like good cinema. I'm not very interested in cinema where the characters are kind of cartoon characters, kind of comic book characters, unidimensional. But when we begin to see the complexity of the characters, and especially when you see change in a character, that's really kind of invigorating. So it's kind of that same sort of thing that we can do through this process called critical thinking. Quote, for the month, the essence of the independent mind lies not in what it thinks, but in how it thinks.
Hmm.
Christopher Hitchens.
Oh, that guy.
Letter
he's
to
so
a young
smart.
Contrarian. Oh, he's passed away now, but he was.
And it's a ton of fun disagreeing with him.
Yeah, but you take your life in your hand, your intellectual life in your hands if you disagree with him. I heard that from a couple of people who have actually been in debate with Christopher Hitchens, but he was quite a thinker. Tonight's topic.
Yeah,
I'm kind of excited about this and a little nervous because we're going to analyze an argument. And this is something I was telling Julia. I think I might need a PowerPoint and whiteboard, which we don't have. So we're going to go through an analysis of an argument. And the reason for that is not because we're going to take sides on this argument one way or the other. It is a real-life issue, but we are going to do it to examine how somebody who took one particular position in this argument might have had to go through the thought process in a critical thinking sort of way. And what's going to pop up is that there's the additional complication of not just critically thinking about how the world is, but how the world should be, going from the is to the ought. When you go from the is to the ought, you go from something that is descriptive about the way the world is to something that is more of a moral, legal, or ethical issue.
Mm-hmm.
How should the world be? What should people do? What should I do? What should the government do? That kind of thing. Mm-hmm. So it's the is to ought transition. And so we're going to do that because when you hear this and note it and understand it, then when you go to all these arguments that are floating around on the internet, and et cetera, you're going to find that a lot of them are of this variety. And so it's good to be able to identify that.
Yeah, absolutely.
So anyway, we're going to uncork the genie tonight and talk about it using critical thinking to examine moral issues. You want me to start it off and lay a little context?
Well, I was going to say let's define our terms.
Okay.
You talked about is and ought, which I think is a really good way to frame it, just to say what moral issues, what is moral? Morality, we tend to think of as being a part of a belief system. But just to, like, again, define our terms,
okay.
Morality is pretty simple. It's principles concerning the distinction between right and wrong,
mm-hmm.
good or bad behavior.
Mm-hmm.
And that's where is, you're saying, is a description of what is. And then there's what ought,
mm-hmm.
that judgment of something being right or something being wrong, something
yeah.
being good and something being bad.
Something we should do or shouldn't do. Something that is our responsibility or not our responsibility. All those are little key
mm-hmm.
words that
yes.
key in that we're not talking about something descriptive. We're talking about something prescriptive, which in philosophy is called being normative, a normative situation. And so basically that's what we're going to talk about tonight.
And we do it all the time of how saying how things ought to be,
Yeah. And they're hidden away,
mm-hmm.
you know. They're kind of hidden in another premise.
That's right.
Or a missing premise in arguments. Okay, so let's start out. Here we when we thought about how to do this, if we just talk about it in kind of theoretical terms, hypothetical terms, it's going to be very confusing. So we have chosen to use a particular topic for it. And we don't want to get in, like I say, to discussing this topic and whether you're pro or con on this topic. That's not what we're doing. We're examining the process.
The mechanics of the argument. We're going to take the mechanics of the argument apart and look at the argument itself and how it's put together and why it leads to where it's going.
Yeah. And an examination of if you were trying to develop an argument or a position one way or the other, the kinds of things that it's important for you to think about.
Yes.
And how much of that is descriptive, the way the world is, versus ought or moral or ethical, the way the world should be.
Well, I think that was a good setup.
All right. Well, let's start back at June 2015 with the California State Senate, when they passed Senate Bill 277. And that was signed into law by Governor Jerry Brown on June 30th, 2015. And that's the bill that removed the personal belief exemptions to vaccination requirements for children who are enrolling in either private or public kindergarten through 12 schools in California, as well as daycare centers. So SB 277 did, however, allow for vaccinations to be waived if the child had an exemption, a medical exemption from an authorized medical profession. But it took away the religious exemption or the personal belief exemption from the parents. When that bill was passed, it meant that your kids, after a certain cutoff date, the kids to enroll had to have their vaccinations up to date. And if they didn't, they couldn't enroll. That meant that they had to then either get vaccinated or they had to leave the public or private school setting and go on independent study or be homeschooled or something like that.
Find an alternative.
It was a controversial issue. People saw it from various different sides. So we're going to examine that issue. Now, passage of that bill effectively provided the state government's answer to this question. As a condition of enrollment, should the state require children in public and private K through 12 schools to be vaccinated, even if their parents object? Okay, so that's just a formulation. So oftentimes you can start out this way if you're trying to examine an argument, especially if it's about something that should be done. ask it as a question, mm-hmm. and then ask yourself what needs to be verified and shown with evidence in order to answer that question.
I think that's a good way to frame it.
Mm-hmm. Okay, so let's examine how critical thinking comes into play in this question. So it seems simple enough stated that way. And it is one of those situations. Remember, if you've listened to the show before, we've talked about these two kinds of cognitive processes that we human beings engage in. One is fast thinking, intuitive. We call it system one. Mm-hmm. And it's biologically programmed into us.
Gut feeling.
It's a gut feeling. Intuition, gut feeling got us a long ways developmentally as a species. It helps protect us. We use it. It's the predominant way that we interact with our environment.
Mm-hmm. It's how I know which side of the road to drive on.
That's right. Reflexive, fast thinking, and tied to our associative memory. The other process that we use is a more rational, deliberate, cognitive, analytic, slower, more resource-intensive process that we and other people refer to as system two. So,
kind of what we like to do here. Burn more calories.
Burn more calories. Weight loss program here, critical thinking. And so stated this way, though, this question is going to appeal to that fast-thinking, intuitive process for many people. We're going to take a hit on it first and see what it how it sounds to us. So some person might say, hell no. Nobody tells me what's in the best interest for my kids.
Mm-hmm.
What else might people respond to? How else might they respond?
You can't tell me what to do.
You can't tell me what to do.
It's one of my favorites.
Or you could have the opposite of that. Well, I guess the legislators have studied this and know what's best.
I don't hear that very often.
No, but many people do. Many people don't want to get into it, and they go, you know, they wouldn't. If they must know what they're doing, you know, to actually pass a law with that and that sort of stuff. Somebody else might say that's just big pharma pushing their drugs and boosting their profits. Okay, you've heard that one.
Oh yeah. Right?
So we take a hit on this. First hit. How does it come out? Okay, what's your hit on it? Now but of course, if you're attempting to be in the Senate and make an argument for make a case for SB 277, you probably are going to want to go beyond just that quick intuitive
I should hope
situation.
So.
So, Eddie, let's examine this. Let's play it out this way. That let's think in terms of a state legislator, state senator. We'll call her Senator Pensar. You know why we call her Senator Pensar?
No, I'm shaking my head.
Anybody know what Pensar means? Pensar is Spanish for thinking.
Oh.
So this is Senator Pensar.
I took German.
As she examines to speak in favor of the bill. So she has to do a little. Let's say that she's leaning in that direction anyway. Maybe she's vaccinated her kids and she's talked it over with her a pediatrician and her brother-in-law is a doctor or works for the CDC or that kind of thing. And that she's leaning in that direction anyway, and she pretty much thinks it's the right thing to do. But she's going to take a critical thinking approach at it and begin to look at the evidence from the very beginning. So let's examine what she would have to do to answer yes to that question, the question that I just asked.
The question, as a condition of enrollment, should the state require children in public and private K-12 schools to be vaccinated, even if their parents object?
Right.
That's our question here.
Yeah. Now, what would she have to, right off the bat, I can see, and by the way, this is an analysis. This is our analysis. You might do your analysis. It may be shaped a little differently. We all might approach this a little differently.
Well, and I like the idea of we're putting ourselves in a legislature's shoes, mm-hmm. and we're exploring what would their thought process be for coming to how they would vote.
Yeah. But in order to answer yes to that, there's a couple claims or premises that have to be true, right? First of all, to say, yes, we should do this. We should pass this legislation. State legislators have to argue that the vaccinations are safe and effective in preventing certain contagious childhood diseases. Now, a scientist would never say vaccinations are safe, because in science, we use the null hypothesis, and we would say there's no evidence that vaccinations are not are harmful. That's the but
because there's room for further evidence down the road. You can't state exactly. something absolutely, because you know every single variation hasn't been attempted. So you're kind of saying that part of a scientific process is to leave a little bit of room to maybe be disproven in the future.
Right. And the way we set up our research, we set up our research so that we want to reject our null hypothesis. So it's just the way the statistics, the research is set up that scientists would be a little more guarded in what they would say. But if the evidence, if there is no evidence that vaccinations are harmful, and when I say harmful, every medical intervention has some side effects and some potential for harm. There can be allergic reactions, severe anaphylactic allergic reactions, but that's about one in a million.
It's a difference between a fluke and a predominant trend.
Exactly. So, but when a state senator is probably arguing, they're not going to be necessarily as nitpicky as a scientist would. So they might argue that that vaccinations are safe and effective in preventing certain contagious childhood diseases. And the other thing is that they also have to argue that, because the whole idea is some parents who would vaccinate their children, they would vaccinate their children and others wouldn't. There has to be some other factor in there that would cause the state to actually pass a law to require the parents. Okay. Mm-hmm. And that other thing is
to interfere with the parents' parenting.
Exactly. Exactly. And that other thing that's there is that there is a certain percentage of children that have to be vaccinated to keep up the illness from spreading in classroom settings. And that's called herd immunity. So if you have to maintain a certain percentage of students, and these students are all in close contact with each other, okay, so contagion is very likely if somebody comes down with one of these diseases. It can spread very quickly. But if around 95% of the people in that group are vaccinated, that's called maintaining the herd immunity. Once that herd immunity starts dropping down in the 80s and lower than that, then it loses its potential for stopping the contagion. And so those two things, that vaccinations are safe and effective, they have to be effective, of course, to advocate for this bill. Otherwise, there would be no grounds at all.
Right. But I think a point you make with herd immunity is that it's that is a collective factor. I'm not explaining this very well, but it's a factor besides just the individual. We're used to making a lot of individual choices that only affect just ourselves. Here, this mm-hmm. is something that is an issue of society, of groups of people. Sometimes they call it community immunity.
Community, I like that, and it's even a little more rigorous than that, because it actually has been shown that once this immunization rate drops to a certain level, that therefore the likelihood that the disease will spread is a lot greater. So the senator would have to get into the literature and understand herd immunity and be convinced that not only are vaccinations safe, relatively safe, up to medical standards safe and effective, but that there is such a thing as herd immunity, that that's not just a bogus concept.
So those are kind of two necessary premises for us to
exactly.
move forward. Okay.
Exactly. So let's say that the senator has gotten into this and she's looked at the literature, she's pros and cons, done a robust search of the literature, and that she's convinced that those two premises are true. All right. Now, both of those are premises about the way the world is, right?
Mm-hmm.
Either vaccines are safe and effective or they're not.
Mm-hmm.
They can be shown to be safe and effective or not. The consensus of the studies, not every single study, but all, you know, as a whole, the studies show that. And that there is such a thing as herd immunity. So those are descriptive statements about the way the world is, essentially empirical facts. So that can be handled by straightforward critical thinking so far, right? You can look at the peer-reviewed research studies and, you know, on vaccinations and target diseases, as well as, you know, studies of side effects and the vaccination rates on groups and that are in contact with each other and all that sort of stuff. So far, so good. Now, the idea here is that there also has to be, well, let's put it this way. The now Senator Pensar can state something like this. She can say, the preponderance of scientific evidence at this point indicates that vaccinations are safe and effective, as defined by standard medical practice. Therefore, the health of the population of K through 12 children in public and private schools is benefited by keeping vaccination rates high enough to maintain herd immunity. So it's just putting those two together. But you notice that those are kind of two claims or premises. There's no conclusion there. So let's put those together and form a conclusion. So we could conclude, if those two premises are true, we could make the following conclusion. The health of the population of K through 12 children in public and private schools is benefited by keeping vaccination rates high enough to maintain herd immunity. So now that can become a premise in a additional argument. And remember, herd immunity is about 95% or so. All right. Now the senator has to introduce one more aspect of the way the world is, and that is that herd immunity is threatened by personal exemptions, right? Mm. Because if it wasn't threatened by personal exemptions, then there wouldn't be any reason for making this mandatory vaccination program.
We would have just kept doing what we've been doing.
Exactly. Status quo, it's working, fine. But there has been a lot of information on the internet about vaccinations' relation to various disorders in kids, everything from autism to weakening their immune system.
Mm-hmm.
And there's been celebrities who have taken up that cause. And so many parents began to object. And so herd immunity was seen as being threatened, and which is really the impetus for passing this in the state. And there were a couple other states before California that did take away any kind of personal exemptions. All right. So she would have to look, Senator Pensar would need to look into the literature now to see if that's true, to see if herd immunity has gone down, to see if this is indeed enough of a threat so that the state has to do something. Again, that's something that is an is statement about the way the world is. Either herd immunity is threatened or it's not, right?
Mm-hmm.
There's no moral issue involved in that. So far we have three premises. We have three issues that we can use critical thinking to figure out as best we can if those are true or not. If those are not true, if one or more of those are not true, then mm-hmm. we don't really have an argument after that.
Well, it certainly compromises the argument.
Yes. Okay.
Because we need all true premises and we need a valid argument formed without fallacies to have a appropriate conclusion,
yep.
to have a true and valid conclusion.
Right. So what the senator is actually trying to argue, though, is something like this. The health of the population of K through 12 children in public and private schools is benefited by keeping vaccination rates high enough to maintain herd immunity, and now wants to say currently herd immunity is threatened by parental personal belief exemptions. Therefore, here now.
That's our conclusion.
Comes our conclusion. As a condition of enrollment, the state should require children in public and private K through 12 schools to be vaccinated, even if their parents object, by passing Senate Bill 277.
Mm-hmm.
So that's the argument, that she needs to get out on the floor and deliver evidence to support.
Mm-hmm. And that should's the same as an ought. It's that moral imperative to that we should be doing something. We've described the universe that we're working with.
Yes.
Through facts that we know to be true.
Yes.
And with those, and by compiling a appropriate, valid argument, we bring ourselves to our moral conclusion that something should be done.
Yes. And now it gets complicated. It was simple up till that point.
Oh, really?
It's always simpler to evaluate how the world is than how it should be, because then we enter this whole domain of morality and ethics and law. Those are all aspects that involve should or ought statements. So we ought to make a law. All right. So where does that leave us? Well, it leaves us in ought territory there. And so it leaves us with how do we actually evaluate moral arguments, all right? And that's been a big contention since the Greeks. Yeah. No philosophers, very few philosophers, well, they form their camps, but a lot of philosophers disagree and psychologists disagree about how, you know, how we really do that or whether it's even possible. All right. But the idea of this show is to introduce this. We're not going to solve all these arguments. We can't tell you how now to process this should argument, this moral or ethical argument. We're going to get into some aspects of it. And we're going to have another show that will go a little bit deeper into it. But so where does that leave us? Well, how do we make the logical connection then between how the world is and how the world ought to be? It's not really immediately apparent. In fact, the 18th century Scottish philosopher David Hume was one of the people who pointed out that it's not obvious how one can coherently move from a descriptive statement to prescriptive statements. In other words, going from the is to the ought. And that problem became known as Hume's law or Hume's guillotine. It was a big corundum for philosophers and a much argued issue. So it's important, though, because now, as we're pointing this out, hopefully you're going to go out and look at stuff that you see on the internet, and you're going to see these shoulds and oughts cropping up or implied in the argument where you just thought everything before just, you know, was a straightforward kind of critical thinking argument, and a lot of the arguments are not. They're complicated by the by how we apply moral principles or how we answer moral questions. For example, somebody might say, Governor Gatby is a man of moral character and a great patriot. Now, we could verify, use critical thinking, look into his record and that kind of stuff, see if he fits in those categories. The rest of it now is, he should be your choice as governor. Okay, whoops.
It's a bit of a leap.
Even if he's a, you know, a great patriot and has all this this great moral character, why should he be my choice? You know, that's, you know, how did we get from the is to the ought? Okay, so let's play a clip just to kind of review this is ought distinction here. This is from the BBC Radio 4 series.
Can you derive what you ought to do from facts about the world? This is a style of argument many people use. They take how things are and use that to draw conclusions about how things should be. For example, we evolved as meat-eating animals. Therefore, we ought to eat meat. Is this a reasonable way of arguing? David Hume thought not. In his view, people move too readily from observations of facts to judgments about values. There's a gap in their reasoning. This is the famous is-ought gap, also known as Hume's law or Hume's guillotine, because he severs any direct connection between facts and values. In the meat-eating example, there's an implied, unstated assumption. We ought to do whatever we evolved to do. But that is a controversial moral premise that vegetarians would dispute. Since Hume described it in the 18th century, numerous moralists have tried to bridge this is-ought gap. They've argued from what is natural or unnatural to what we should or shouldn't do, from facts about what makes human beings happy to evaluations of what we should do next, or from discoveries about human biology to claims about how we ought to live. If Hume was right, they've all committed a logical mistake.
right. Is odd. I thought that was a good little summary.
Yeah, it was a fun little clip. I think it drove the point home.
Yeah. So where does that leave us? Well, it's apparent that that additionally, where we're at in the argument, that the center's argument needs to make a case that the state has a responsibility to maximize children's health. Okay. Somewhere there has to be, that has to be codified in law or agreed upon or any, so that the state has that responsibility. And also argue that the state has a responsibility to protect the kids in school who can't be vaccinated for medical reasons in order to protect them from outbreaks caused by endangering herd immunity. Because that's another issue in herd immunity, is that you do have some kids whose immune system is compromised already. And so if they catch some of these diseases, it can be life-threatening mm-hmm. to them. And so you have to make the argument that the state has a responsibility to protect those kids, too, by maintaining herd immunity mm-hmm. that is being endangered by the personal exemption. So those are all things that you can normally, if you start thinking about these issues in some depth, that will come to your mind. You think, what has to be shown to answer the question? What has to be shown to come to this conclusion? And so you find out that the argument becomes much more complex than you thought it was to start with.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, you also, it's got to be shown that the state responsibility takes precedence. This is the big one, over the right of parents to decide whether or not to vaccinate their children, and that the state is overriding the parents' right to enroll their kids in public or private schools being unvaccinated.
Mm-hmm. That's a tricky one.
That's the tough one, mm-hmm. right? And how do we show that? How do we verify? What moral arguments or legal arguments do we use to support that? Well, we're not going to settle this debate for you. We're going to kind of leave you hanging on this, but
I was really hoping we could just finish this thing up right here.
You know, I have some things to say about what some philosophers would say and what some psychologists would say, because the philosophers look at how should we deal with these kinds of moral arguments. And there's great debates. People have spent lifetimes thinking about this and discussing it.
For philosophers, they call that job security.
Exactly. Exactly. And it's a tough one. And there's lots of good arguments. If you start getting into these arguments, you're swayed one way in one instance and another in another instance. So that's been great and healthy and robust debate through the years. But there's another group of people who are looking at this too, and that's neuroscientists, psychologists, social scientists, economists, and those folks who investigate the descriptive part of that, which is not what human beings should do, but how do human beings do it right now? You know, so that's more back on the is, you know, what is the world? How do human beings come to these decisions? That's descriptive rather than normative or prescriptive. So the idea is to put together what the philosophers say and to get some sense of that, of the alternatives that philosophers engage in terms of moral reasoning, and look at the information from the social sciences to see how human beings typically do it, to become sort of look at our metacognition and to begin to understand what kinds of processes we go through when we actually do that. And that's what critical thinking does. It recognizes the philosophical aspects. It recognizes the scientific information that comes out about how we actually think about these things. Speechless.
I am.
Well, I'll tell you what.
Engrossed.
We won't leave you quite this hanging, because we do have some more things to say about specifics about how philosophers, kind of teasers about how philosophers think about these things, the different alternatives that we can talk about, and a little bit of brief information about what psychologists have found. And we can talk about that. But I see it's about 7:42 right now. And so we will talk about that, but we will also open the phone lines at this time. Topic is moral arguments, is ought question. questions about how we've analyzed this argument. We don't want to get into a debate about the specifics of the argument. Remember, we're focusing here in Thinking Clearly. We're focusing on the process of critical thinking.
I think we have a caller.
Okay.
Look at that.
All right, caller.
Hello, caller.
All right. Okay, I've been enjoying this, but it's going too fast for me. I find herd immunity is a very interesting topic, and I think that a little more detail about what the nature of it is would be in order before we make our decision on what public policy ought to be. As I understand it, herd immunity is the principle that if everyone in the classroom is immune and can't have the disease in the classroom, in the school, then obviously even a very vulnerable kid can't catch whatever it is, smallpox or whatever you're vaccinating against. But if practically no one is immune, then even one kid with a serious disease, well, let's keep talking about smallpox, but it applies in general. Even one kid enrolled in there is going to do a hell of a lot of damage, right?
That's right.
And so the idea of herd immunity is that if enough kids are incapable of passing on the evil disease, then the danger to a kid who is vulnerable is decreased. And at some point, depending on the nature of the disease and its communicability and how easy it is to get it from another kid who may have it, that the herd immunity level will be dependent on that particular disease, as well as on the seating in the classroom, or whether people are close together or not, and so on. So herd immunity, I think, for any given disease, is a variable that depends on quite a few conditions. You can't declare that you either have it or you don't unless, am I making a point?
Oh, yeah, you're yes, and I thank you very much for clarifying that.
Yeah, I think that's a good point to make, because what the people in the school district, it would be easy for them to say everybody has to be vaccinated in order to get into my school. I'm getting ahead of myself here. But what the school district wants to do is give the maximum reasonable amount of protection to the maximum number of kids.
Yeah.
And so if they have the sense that 95% immunization is adequate, so that it would be very improbable that one of the few vulnerable kids is going to catch the disease from one of the few kids who are capable of getting the disease, then they get to set that level well below 95% or 100%, 99% immunization. But there is a judgment call to be made there on the basis of what the probability is that an infectious disease will go sailing through the school. And that's why they don't have to require under 100% immunization in order to let the kid in.
Yeah.
Now I gather that the school, having allowed these, what do they call it, conscientious?
Personal exemptions.
The kids whose parents say our religion doesn't permit this,
yes,
so you can't keep my kid out of school because the religion comes first, and the education he's entitled to because it's a public school. So you can't have this rule that I've got to immunize him or he can't come in. And I believe that that was tried, and I suspect that the reason that they went to eliminating the easy out,
yes,
just say, for the parents just to say, we have a religious objection, is that probably the incidence of the diseases they were trying to immunize against was getting high enough to show that this herd immunity vague concept has been violated by allowing enough, a sufficient number of people to bring the diseases into the school and pass them on to the other kids who...
Yeah.
Do you have a sense
reason
that the school boards have changed, or the state legislature has changed the rules about allowing the conscientious objection to no longer be recognized that
Like we said, as we analyzed the argument, what we were doing is analyzing what would have to be shown in an argument, and so there would have to be evidence shown that that herd immunity was getting dangerously to the point where the herd immunity effect would collapse and allow the spread of the disease, and it's not only to kids who are also in the classroom, but if you that haven't been vaccinated or couldn't be vaccinated for medical reasons, but it's also for people that may be living at home with those kids that are vulnerable, that have compromised immune systems, the elderly, and that sort of thing.
Oh, well, and now you're getting into a different subject, because the school district, some people would maintain, has no business protecting your home. The people that aren't in the school the government would have no business saying everybody has to do this because someone in the population is likely to be damaged if we don't make everybody do this.
Yeah.
And my argument was going to be just to justify that if you're going to utilize the public school facilities, then it's reasonable for the school to say we must protect the all the other students in the school by insisting on general immunity.
I'm sure.
But if I misunderstood, I hope you to say be saying that the school district is reaching out now to protect all the people who aren't in school by becoming a public health agency and preventing anybody who has a disease from circulating in general. That, I think, is a very different philosophical and political argument.
Yeah, and I'm not saying that that was a crucial part of the argument. I'm just saying that's another artifact, another thing to look at. But I take your point there that opens up a whole other issue of what the state's responsibility is. So I'm not saying that this is the exact argument that they use that as a pivotal part of the argument for passing the law. I'm just saying that's another aspect of it that I've read that people throw in terms of just another issue.
Well,
of it spreading.
Yeah, I want to get off here. I've spent an awful lot of time on the air, but I do want to make the point that it's very important whether you justify a good position with a bad argument or not. And in my view, bringing in the argument for general public health is affected this way, and therefore nobody should be able to get a public education unless they are immunized, is putting your foot in the oompa.
Yeah, and I'm not trying to put that argument forward. I'm just saying that was another aspect that I have heard mentioned, not necessarily as an argument that was argued in the Senate for passing this bill. Okay, thank you.
Okay,
thank you.
Okay,
no, but thank you very much for calling and clarifying that and making sure that other folks understood herd immunity in more detail. Thank you. And
we have another, more callers.
Yeah. Welcome to Thinking Clearly.
Hello, caller.
I was kind of disappointed that talking about critical thinking, and then you just accepted the premises as they've been put forth to us without examining the source of the data and the motivations of highly centralized political systems like CDCC, World Health, which are highly influenced by the monies that be, the powers that shouldn't be.
Let me explain that. Let me explain that.
Several things I'd like to bring up. This is just one. I mean, examine the source. That's like the beginning of critical thinking.
Okay, but let me stop you right there, and then we'll get to the rest of your points. Is that we are not. Well, the idea of this show and at this topic that we have, we are not putting forth an argument. We're putting forth the process that a person would have to go through. So
I heard you, and I'm saying the number one thing is examine the source.
Oh, definitely.
Of your information.
Oh, definitely. The senator who put forth this argument would have to have gone to the literature, would have to have gone to various sources to be convinced that the premises that she was accepting as true were true.
Well, I'd say you have to go beyond the common literature, the arguments that have been put forth that we're supposed to look at. rather than has the health of children in general improved or not? Is the delivery system the optimal delivery system? I mean, to me, it should be oral, it should not be bypassing the defense mechanisms, etc., and that could be causing hyperinflammatory reactions, which immune system diseases, et cetera, et cetera.
Okay, I agree with you completely that a robust search of the evidence and all the topics that relate to the premises that you're using in your argument should be examined. We have two other callers. Did you have some other points that you wanted to make?
On the philosophical, there's also the forcing of schooling or the paying for schooling in general. And I guess I'll let it go at that.
Okay, thank you. Thank you very much. Thanks, because you pointed out how complicated the argument is, that it's not as simple as
Also, is it just vaccinations, or are there other things in the vaccinations, and what are the appropriate reasons?
Again, yes. To look at the literature and go through the details of to support the premises.
Okay,
very important.
The literature. Okay.
Okay, thank you very much. Next caller, welcome to Thinking Clearly.
But I just wanted to tell the speaker very quickly that I've got to get this straight. My eldest son got his vaccinations when he was a baby, and he came down with polio. A light case of polio, and the clinic said, oh, we must have given him some bad stuff out of a bad batch. His legs were skinny. He grew up very skinny and finally started getting stronger and stronger, so I wouldn't have to carry him after walking about a block to a block and a half downtown.
Okay,
then
okay,
my youngest son got the DPT vaccination, came down with grand mal seizures and fell down. He never did. It took him till the fourth grade. I would have to have the ER come and get him or put him in the car real quick and drive him down to the emergency room. And they said at the clinic that he must have gotten some out of a bad batch.
Okay.
That was in 1983 with my youngest son.
Let me stop you for a minute,
then
that's an anecdotal the thing that is sounds like is very close to the caller's heart there, but it's not what we're doing tonight. We're examining the process of the thinking, not trying to cite anecdotal evidence one way or the other for it. So we have two more callers. We're going to have to take those quickly.
Four more minutes. So
yes.
let's see what we can do.
So go ahead.
Hello, caller.
Welcome.
Hello.
We've got just a couple minutes. What can we do for you?
Yeah. I was wondering. You talk about evolution like it was a fact. I mean, you just
no. We're not talking about evolution.
Evolution
is not tonight's topic. Evolution is not tonight's topic.
I know, but you brought it up. You said something about in our evolution. You said evolution, the word evolution. When you
but
said
that's
the word
not,
evolution,
sorry, that's not the tonight's topic. So let's go to the next caller.
Oh, all right. Well, we're just finishing up our. Show
okay,
here.
Did we have another caller?
I don't think we do.
Oh, okay.
That
all right.
It.
Yeah, it's difficult. To do a show like this and to actually, have people engage the points. And we're in this show, Thinking Clearly, we're really trying to stick with the process. And I know that when we bring things up as examples, that people take it personally. People have personal experiences where they've already made up their mind. For example, that vaccinations, can cause certain kinds of illnesses, and it's very close and it's very personal, and it can be heartbreaking for that. But we're not here to examine that kind of issue. We're here to examine the thought process. That's the whole idea, is to dissociate the stories that we hear from the process of thinking that we must go through in order to find out what is verified and supported and what isn't.
I like to think of it, one of my personal principles in this show is that we don't, I am not here to tell people what to think.
Exactly.
That is the last thing I ever want to do, is tell someone else what they should be thinking. We're here to discuss how we can go about thinking, and so people can come to their own conclusions, so they can work it out. They have the tools in their toolbox to wade through this very complicated and messy world. Mm-hmm. And I hope that we've done some of that for folks tonight.
And we're going to have a follow-up show to this where we get into a little bit of the psychology behind moral decisions, the philosophy behind moral decisions, and the arguments pro and con for how people actually best can sort out these, that kind of intuitive gut-level feeling, and supply some actual evidence for coming up with a moral decision. Pay attention to how much and how many of these things that you hear, these arguments that you hear, especially on the internet, are involving moral issues, ought or should statements, as opposed to the way the world is. Okay, any last word?
Find us on Facebook, Thinking Clearly Radio.
Or podcast at thinkingclearly.libsyn.com.
Yeah, just look us up in your podcast app.
For yourself, little friend. Is it you that they like, or is it the money?
This program was produced in KMUD's Redway Studios and is provided courtesy of KMUD, People-Powered Radio.